You're listening to the Brenton Not On Tour Quarantine Cast. So far, he's taught you about good coffee.
Damn, Jimmy, this is some serious gourmet shit.
Good music.
I'm like this, you know, and then that becomes your thing. Music just does that.
And the secrets to good travel.
Exits. Okay, there's one back here.
And there's probably one over by the wing somewhere.
Now, thanks to COVID-19, he's here to make sure that you're all good during this time of social distancing and self-isolation. So sit back and enjoy as he broadcasts from any number of exotic locations like Costa del Balconia, La Isla del Garage, Playa del Living Room, and the always magical Puerta Vallarta. And don't worry, he's already had the coronavirus and beat it.
Still, maybe keep a mask handy.
Here's BD.
Finally.
Hello. I think, I don't know why, like, you were requesting me and I was accepting the request and then it was not working and then I was like sending you the request at the same time and it was weird. Anyways.
Technology is a wonderful thing. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm really good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here. It's amazing weather here. I'm in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Ooh, all right. So you're up at the top. I thought you were in the west coast of United States.
No, I'm up in Canada. I'm up in the good half of North America.
That's a good one. Yep. Well, I already told you before, but I love your background. I'm going to get one of those in Amazon.
No problem. Anytime. I'm happy to be here. I'm glad that you started this platform for everyone to check out and listen to and learn some stuff. So hopefully.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially you.
No, you won't. No, you won't. And this is being recorded. So later it will be in my IGTV and in the week, probably in like, I don't know, at the end of July, it will be in YouTube so everyone can watch it. But yeah, don't worry. I won't ask things that's too much.
All good. Happy to be here.
So as I was telling everyone before you joined, you are Brenton Dunnelly. You've done more than 100 stadium shows, which is a bit much. I don't know how you survived.
Well, you know, it's we work towards doing that level of show when you start out, and then you know it's kind of like a mission to. Do stadiums, you think, when you start doing concerts for a living, I got to do stadiums. I can't wait to do stadiums. And then you realize once you get there that it's, you maybe go back to do a club. I love walking out and seeing, you know, 80,000 or 50,000 or 30,000 or whatever we do for that. It's an amazing feeling because all the departments and everyone's come together at the same time to make that show happen. And it's a great feeling and everyone has something to do that night because of, you know, because it all came together and it's a great feeling, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work and there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah. It's like a big machine. Like there's a lot of engines, which are the people who are working inside and then the people who watch the show and everything.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tight knit group of people, and usually a lot of the same people that you encounter and work with. So it makes it a little bit easier. So it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. So let's start the interview if you want to. Yeah. Sure. All right. So the first question that I always ask to my guests is, how did music get into your life?
Well, it was very prominent in my family. So my dad was played in a band in the, you know, 50s and 60s and used to open up for a big band called the Dave Clark Five. I don't know. He used to play around. And so they were like a big, big band in the U.S. and he would tour around and do shows. And so when I came into the mix, they were still doing band practices and stuff in the basement. And it just seemed awesome. Like, what are these drums and what is this, these microphones and all that stuff. So that was one side of it. On my mom's side of the family, always extremely musical. My grandpa had a radio show. So that was awesome to watch go down to the basement, and he had a little, you know, a little mini studio. And I always was like, wow, what, like, these microphones and all these really cool things that were just, you know, to like an 8-year-old or a 7-year-old would be like, what is this? And then you put on pretend shows and stuff. Oh, I see my Damish has joined us. Hey, Damish, how are you, buddy? So then I basically took it from there, and then it just was so prominent growing up that I really wanted to, I felt like, you know, I wanted to play something. So I started playing drums and trying to, you know, become a rock star, as they say. And that was sort of like the beginning of the journey for me. It was music through the family, always music at Christmas and always music at various kind of things and family gatherings. And it rubs off on you, and you just take it from there and kind of run with it. So that's how the music side started for me. Yeah.
Cool. So you can say that all the cool stuff started in basements.
Well, I mean, I think almost every single musician you're going to speak to has started in a basement or in their room or in front of a mirror with a tennis racket, whatever it's going to be. There was some kind of thing that set the tone for what they wanted to do. And that, you know, to me, would have been just watching all this amazing music around me at all times.
Mm-hmm. And having having such a musical family from both sides, did you know from the beginning that you wanted to be part of the music industry?
So when you're young, you don't know what the music industry is. You just know that you want to do it. But I was always into, I'm always a big fan of, I used to read magazines where they would break down records. They would break down how they made albums, you know, and like, oh, this is the first track, and this is, this is how we made the song, or this is, you know, this is our thought process. And I remember, when I started reading liner notes on albums, that's when I started kind of going, what is a producer? What's an engineer? Like, you know, what's ASCAP? What's Sony? What's, you know, BMI? Like, what are all these different, like, music licensing things? I started researching it, obviously, well before the internet. You had to get that information, like, by reading
in the library or something.
Yeah, so then it was just one of those things where I slowly moved into, like, it was always like be in a band and break it, you know, and I loved reading album stories about how they were made and things like that, and it just led to being in a band, and being in a band for years with some great guys, and it was amazing to be a part of that. And that really set the tone, because then you could start seeing all the other jobs in the music industry. And that's when I was like, yeah, that for sure, I want to be in this for the rest of my life. So,
So did you play any instruments?
Yeah, I was a drummer in my past life.
In my past life.
I was a drummer in my past life. Yeah. And, every now and again, I can get behind them and you know, still carry a little bit of a beat, but it's just a beat to me now at this point. But it's fun.
Yeah, I always say that both drummers and bassists have like 7 lives.
Well, you know, you're going to find too that there's a lot of drummer and bass player jokes, but you're also going to find that a lot of drummers and bass players are the ones tasked with getting things done a lot. So there's a bit of that too. So because yeah. You know, it's just like, you know, often there was the joke, everyone laughs when a drummer comes to the table and says, well, I wrote a song. And they go, well, that's nice. But, you know, guitar players and say,
yeah, there are so many, jokes.
You know, unless, you know, there's a lot of different things, a lot of great, great people in different roles. But I was never like a great drummer. I was able to get by. But for sure, there was that feeling that maybe this side of the world, running concerts and tour managing and things like that, was probably more where I was going to end up, because it's the 10,000 hours. I've put 10,000 hours into running concerts, but I haven't put, you know, I might have put 10,000 hours into drumming, but to become a better drummer, taking lessons, things like that, it was just kind of full on frantic, go play punk rock, have some fun and have a great time. I never really focused on becoming like the best drummer. And I think that's, that in the end, you kind of go where your strengths are, and it was mm-hmm. this way.
Yeah.
We got our Hoogie just joined. It's Hoogie's birthday. So
really?
happy birthday, Hoogie. You just joined us here. Yeah, Hoogie's a great guy. Another amazing candidate for your show. So you need to, Hoogie, check out Live versus Live and try to get yourself on here.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. Man.
Great guy. Happy birthday. I see him all over the world. He's a great guy. So, great guy.
Awesome. Well, coming back to the interview, what was then your first job in the music industry?
So what I ended up doing is while playing in a band, we tried to get on all these shows all the time, right? And so what ended up happening was I was given an opportunity to start putting on my own concerts. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went and the first thing I was in college, I started volunteering a lot. So I started volunteering at that live concerts, which is extremely important for anyone getting into it. You've got to get yourself, you know, you got to volunteer as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that stuff that happened when I was volunteering at the beginning of my career, which was like 94, 95, those people are still in my life. They're still running shows. So one of the first tour managers that I ever met, a guy named Fabby, he does what I do. We travel around and run concerts, and we, you know, he does what I do now. And we're in touch, like, you know, at least once a month just to say hi. But I met him in like 93. You know, so I was volunteering at concerts, and that was technically the first job. Concerts and clubs. There was a club in my hometown that I used to go and volunteer at and help push equipment and push gear. And you know, it was a big thing for me, 18 years old, to like load in a band's gear, especially a band that you liked. I don't know.
For me, anyway. Yeah.
And that led to meeting tour managers and our band was playing a lot, and we were putting on concerts, and then we were opening up a lot of the concerts. So that was really cool. And then those tour managers kind of started being like, hey, what are you doing right now? I need a tour manager, which is funny because I think that's where I first met Hoogie, who just joined us. I met him managing a band in Chatham or something like that. But so that's kind of where it started. It started as a tour manager. That was kind of my first job, was taking some bands that were just developing and going across Canada with them and managing their daily life on the road, which in essence, all the people that I met on that first tour, I still work with today. So.
Whoa, that's amazing. And did you actually learn how to be a tour manager, let's say, on the road, or did they like teach you before or something?
No, you're on the road. You basically, you know, thankfully I had a manager that was kind of guiding me. I had agents that was a friend of mine that was like, you know, just make sure they get to the gig, make sure the accounting is good. No one dies. No one gets anybody pregnant.
Like, that's a good point.
Make sure, you know, but also, you know, you're representing the band out there. Like, as far as you're the first point of contact for a lot of tour manager, or for a lot of like promoter reps like me, or, you know, they want to, you never talk to the band. You talk to their lighting guy or their audio guy or their tour manager. Mm-hmm. So you're the first point of contact. So you have to be, on it. You got to be, you know, I've met a lot of guys that aren't on it. I still deal with a lot of tour managers, you know, on the smaller side that aren't on it, but, you got to just be, you have to be on top of your game as best as you can. And you kind of learn as you go. Mm-hmm. And then you take on different roles. Cause in Canada, for instance, it's really tough to be just a tour manager. You have to be able to mix the band, be able to do, audio or lighting and stuff. And that's really, really tough, to be a tour manager in Canada for a smaller band. Oh, really anywhere in the world for a smaller band. Yeah. When you're mixing them and you're, you know, advancing the show, calling and getting all the things done, plus you're driving and you're, you know, so it's a tough gig, but it really helps you lay the foundation for your career. And a lot of tour managers make the best promoter reps. So what I do now, a lot of tour managers can slide right into that role really, really easy. So
when you did, like, you were touring at first just in Canada, and when was the point, like, how did it happen that you stopped just touring in Canada and you started traveling all around the world?
So first thing was I moved to Vancouver, and all those guys that I had, I'm from Toronto, but I had moved to Vancouver, and all the guys that I had met on the first tour that I'd gone on were working for House of Blues Concerts at the time in Vancouver. Live Nation had just purchased or merged with House of Blues and bought mm-hmm. them. And the guys that I had known that, you know, were promoter reps when I was tour managing had called me and said, hey, we're going to go from 200 shows a year to 800 shows in Western Canada. So we need to train some guys up. Are you interested? So I said 100%. It's all all I ever wanted to do was work for House of Blues, Live Nation. It used to be Universal Concerts. When I was like 18, 19 and in college, I was working towards working for that company. So it was a dream come true for me to get a chance to do that. So it started by working shows locally in Vancouver at a club level, learning load in, where to park the cars, working with the budget, how you work with a band that's only getting paid $500, but you have to, you know, you've got a $5,000 budget for the show for rent and catering and marketing and all these kind of things. And so you have to learn how it works at that club level. And then you get an opportunity to move to theater level. And then it's a small theater, then a small arena, and then a bigger arena. And then you get to start going across Western Canada. So that went on for a few years. And then around 2012 or 2013, one of my mentors and one of the guys who really brought me along started running started helping with the touring division across the world with Live Nation, and had asked me if I'd be interested in coming over and doing, you know, one or two tours a year in Europe. And that was around, I think it was around 2012 or 2013, where I was like, okay, here we go. It's a whole new thing. I've never been to any of these venues. I've never been to anything, but thankfully there was an infrastructure in place, and you just kind of, you take the fundamentals of what you learned from club theater level here in Canada, and it kind of crosses over all over the world. It's just a different language, or it's a different
kind
of rules for labor and crew, but you make it work, and that's what happened. So that was around 2012, 2013. After about 5 years in Canada, across Western Canada, doing clubs, theaters, and small arenas. Yeah. That's what started getting really, really busy for me. So.
This is amazing. Actually, I have a question. You mentioned the language. How do you deal with that? Like when you are imagined in Asia, how do you like communicate with?
I've never been to Asia outside of my wife is Chinese, and I've been to southern China a bunch, but generally speaking, there's a local representative in every market.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one of me in every market that is mm-hmm. fluent in English, usually. So in general, like I've never done a show in any market where someone there didn't speak English that could translate what we're trying to do. So if that's the case where your crew, everything is in French and mm-hmm. no one speaks a lick of English except for your rep that's local in Paris, then you do everything through that rep and then you show up and communicate with that person for that day. And then, you know, the more times you go over, the more times you start recognizing people, and then the more people you start working with are the same, and then you just build a rapport. So that's the idea about consistently going over, is now I'm pretty much working with the same people in every market now.
Mm-hmm. So, got it. And
it's no different than, say, across Canada, like it's the same person in Winnipeg, it's the same person in Calgary or Edmonton. It's usually the same people in all those markets. That's mm-hmm. the same. Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now that we're talking about touring reps, what do you actually do in your current job?
So there's a lot of factors in it. So there's a lot of different roles attached to it. Generally speaking, you mm-hmm. are part of a tour from inception. Mm-hmm. So we have reps that, you know, like that are in on, you know, from ticketing that basically mm-hmm. come in and they help build it from a ticketing standpoint. They're in, you know, you basically take the idea of the tour. The ticketing team comes in, all the different departments come in and kind of build the concert. And then, you know, it's basically handed over to me to connect all the departments, and then I go out and basically from we review every single market that we're going into. We keep an eye on ticketing. We keep an eye on how it's doing overall, how sales are doing, how, you know, it's any production issues. They come through me as far as like, oh, we have to, this market, we can't do pyro, or this market, we have to reduce the size of the show because it doesn't fit into the building. Or it's just basically taking all the departments. In essence, it's taking all the departments, bringing them together and overseeing it on behalf of the company, and then all their own little things. So we've got a great ticketing person. She does so much for us over in Europe. She'd be another great guest, but then she does so much for us in Europe. And some people are more involved in that front on ticketing. Other times it's just handed over and the ticketing has already been kind of taken care of. There's so many kind of factors, but the core of it is, in essence, bringing all the departments together, connecting the dots, answering all the questions, building the tour based out on what the production manager is designing for the act, talking to our local team in every market to see if it's going to work, communicating with the buyers of the tour to make sure if there's any issues, communicating with ticketing, trying to open up more seats on a daily basis, making sure there's no security issues. Like, there's just, it's basically all encompassing. And then hopefully by the time you get to the show, it's running smooth. Mm-hmm. All the work is done preliminary before you get there. So in essence, you're putting out, you might be opening more tickets. There's maybe a couple of daily things that you have to kind of deal with, but hopefully all the work that you've put in prior to the tour leads to a smooth tour. You know, you just never know what's going to get thrown at you, but it happens.
Yeah. And do you believe the way of building tours, let's say, like creating tours, has changed since the beginning, since the moment that you started?
Well, I mean, so the core of any tour that I've run, whether it be from a theater or a club tour or as a tour manager, in essence, it's the same. The band wants to go out. They need a place to play. So it gets routed, you know, so it's going to go London. It's going to go to Birmingham. It's going to go, you know, wherever it's going to go, Paris. We're going to, you know, you're going to see the same kind of routing. And for the most part, core of touring is in essence the same. The band wants to go out. This is how much money they want. These are the agents and the buyers will try to route it. And then they hand it over and we go run and try to make it work. A lot of things have changed from the with VIP packages, and there's all these different kind of things that are built within the touring world or built within the show. But the core of the show is band wants to go on tour, has an album to promote, agents, buyers, production people get together to find out all the best markets to put those in. They put them in. And then we go run it. So anything else around that, it's going to change all the time. You're going to have a new VIP package. You're going to have a virtual experience. You're going to have something on your phone. All the little tiny things will consistently change over the years. But the core of it is band goes on tour. Band needs a place to play. Person buys ticket. Band plays. Band leaves.
Got it. That was so, like, I love it. It was so schematical and the dots is like, it makes sense. Like, it's the same that when you were doing gigs back in Canada, I guess, at the beginning of everything, that it was like a band that wanted to go on tour because they were promoting it as a CD or an album or whatever.
It really becomes a venue thing because it becomes availability. Like, when it's obviously we're in a different time right now and things have shut down for a little while, but if you reverse back to just even September or August or something like that, loads of bands want to go on tour. Loads of bands need to find a venue to play. So they can't go play those venues if they're booked by other tours, right? That's just the core of it. So they have to build around what's already built. So that is the same. And but in essence, it's practically the same routing in Europe. Go to the same venues in Australia at the same kind of pace. Professionals and people have been doing it for years and years and have worked out just the fastest, best way to do it. So you're not doing, unless you're touring in Canada, which is like eight to, you know, can be like 8 hours in between shows. It's more like, it's, you know, but it's, you go, you know, Vancouver, Kelowna, Edmonton, Calgary, or you go Calgary, Edmonton, Saskatoon, Regina. Like, it's the same kind of cadence. So in Europe, it's kind of the same thing where it's starts maybe in Spain and you come back, or you start, you know, you start in London and go that way, or you start, like, there's just so, or you just focus on one region like the UK, and then you switch and go to, you know, France.
Yeah.
They're kind of the same. They kind of all flow the same, really.
Is it that because it reduces costs? So it's already studied by someone that says, okay, so it's probably more beneficial for us to go from this city to this city than going from like this city to this city.
Now, it doesn't, excuse me, it doesn't always work like that. Obviously, sometimes a 14-hour drive up to come back to where you started to go over, because just the way the routing and the way that the venue availability was. But in essence, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of work put into it, and just the sheer enormity of a tour, you know, when you're trying to move anywhere between 8 to 20 trucks around the world, or around, you know, you want to do it as efficiently as possible. You want to spend the least amount of gas. You want to spend, you know, you don't want to be putting, or try not to be putting your crew through, you know, loading out at 2 in the morning, driving 4 hours and loading back in at 6 in the morning every single day. Like, there's sort of like, there is a bit of a cadence to it, that works efficiently from a financial standpoint, effectively for your crew and labor, and what, you know, that there's been a lot of thought that's gone into that, you know?
So many minds thinking at the same time. I love it.
way smarter minds than me, I'll tell you, but yes.
I'm gonna ask you something about, like, your, let's say, a tour life. So, like, the touring life. What do you prefer, the first day of a tour or the last one?
That's a good question. The first day of the tour is always a bit frantic, because you, in essence, are, this is, you know, if you've done your job, you're meeting everybody, you're excited to see how the show is going to go. You kind of look at it and go, oh, okay, I see now, I get it. So I always love the first day of a tour. Hey, Drew, what's up, buddy? I always love the first day of a tour, because it really is the culmination of everything you've been working on for 3 months prior to, and you meet everybody, and especially if it's a tour where you know a lot of people. So if you know a tour manager already, you've already been out with them, a production manager, a lighting guy, a front of house guy, or a guitar tech that's a buddy of yours, or a monitor guy, you're like, oh, this is going to be great. These guys are awesome. They've hired the right people. So you kind of go into it knowing that it's going to be, you know, as smooth as everyone's worked together to try to make it as smooth as possible. The last day of the tour, is not necessarily as frantic, but on the touring side, it can be, because they've got to pack up all their gear. They've got to ship it somewhere. They've got to do stuff. So you really have to be dialed in leading into the last day, or try to be wrapping up as much as you can into the last day, because getting anyone's attention on that last day, when the tour is done, people go home. They don't want to talk about it. So, like, if you've got any outstanding accounting that has to be done, or any kind of touring that's like any kind of issues that, it's tougher to get guys to respond to you a week after, or a couple of days after, because they just want to turn their brain off and go away. So, hey, Helen's here. Hi, Helen.
Yeah, she is. Hey.
Hi, Helen. It's tougher to, Helen would be able to answer that question really well, because she's
100%.
She's 100%. But I think for me personally, I like the first day of the tour over the last day of the tour, because the last day of the tour, especially if it's not a tour that's going to continue and you're not going to see the people for a year, it can be a little bit like, you know, we just spent 2 months together and now we won't see you for a year. The beginning of the tour is more the fruits of your work, the culmination of everything and all the departments coming together. So for me, it's a little bit more, I'm more excited about the first day of a tour.
Yeah.
You know?
So do you actually, like, on the first day when you're packing your things to go on the first day of your tour, how does it feel?
Well, I mean, I have a family, so obviously it's a bit, it's, you know, they, as we lead into leaving, it's a bit like, okay, well, I'm going away for maybe 2 months or 6 weeks or 3 months. And so there's always a little bit of like, do I have everything? Am I good? And then the home, it's like, are we set? Are we good here? Is everyone comfortable? Are we ready to, you know, it's school in? Do we have a bit of a routine already in place? Kids are a little bit older now, so like, it's a bit easier now, but I've come through, like, I've been touring their whole life, and that's, you know, a while. So there's been all these different kind of scenarios of like, where am I going? And when do I see you again? And things like that. So it's a little tougher on that side because you, in essence, are going. Now, if you've been home for a long time, everyone's usually like, when are you going on tour? When's it? Can we drive you to the airport? You know, we know that you're not going to be going until Friday, but do you want to go on Monday just to be there? Like, so, you know, there's a bit of that.
They are like kicking you out slowly, like really.
You know, where it gets a little bit different is when you're, when you come, like last year, like for instance, when I was on Chris Brown and then I was supposed to come home, and then I got a call like 2 days before I was supposed to come home to stay out with Rihanna. And that was going to put me for another 6 weeks, and I'd already been gone for 6 weeks. So it was kind of like, I gotta stay up for six more weeks, but it's like, you know, 30 stadium shows. So
yeah,
it's like, you have to do what you have to do for your career,
actually,
right?
So, like, yeah. Is that actually like mental healthy?
Mentally it's tough. Mentally it can be tough. You have to a lot of people struggle with touring, and I don't blame them. I mean, you're away from home, it's a bit of a thing. I did a bit of a piece, obviously, you know, I have the podcast as well, where I talk a little bit about, you know, it's had four different modules, but I've had when I did the music section of the podcast, I really wanted to focus on mental health and how we were all doing in the business. And, you know, not everyone is good. Not everyone wants to go home. Some people, home is on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, you know, being home is very difficult. It's more difficult than being on the road, you know, because you have to adjust to, oh my God, I haven't had to do anything responsible for, you know, for a while, but now I have. So there's a bit of like, mentally it can be tough. You've got to really, I always liken to going on tour as getting ready for like a fight, like a boxer getting ready to go on a fight. So I always, like, for 6 weeks, like, I try to, you know, try to be as healthy as I can and do what I can do to prep. But you know, say for sure, for the 6 weeks leading into a tour, I up everything. I up my, you know, I up my gym as much as I can. I up my, you know, I don't drink anymore. So it's like, I'm trying to do all these things to like be as strong as I can be mentally to go on tour and physically, because after 6 weeks, no matter what you do, you're never going to get to the gym as much as you want. You're never going to eat properly, as you know, you'll eat a lot. So you gotta be like, you know, you can be back, you can be up 30 pounds after coming back on tour. So that's all of it. Like, it's the mental side of it is, there's so much. You're not getting enough sleep. You're not, getting, you know, if you've got any kind of lingering health issues, you know, it's tougher to get help out on the road. You know what I mean? You've got a sore back, but you gotta, you got the migraines all the time. If you, there's so many factors that the road doesn't care about. So if you go out, you've got to, I feel like you've got to be, you've got to prep and try to get yourself to a good spot to be able to take on 6 weeks of getting punched, because that's what it is. In essence, it's you're just getting hammered down, no sleep. You're like tired, and you got to get up and do another 16-hour day, and it's like it can be a little grueling.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. What's actually the longest that you've been in a tour for?
Well, I mean, I did 3 months, and then I did last summer. I was out, and then I went out, and then I went out. So I went out in Europe, and then I had to fly from London to start Korn and Alice in Chains in America. And then while I was out on Korn and Alice in Chains in America, they asked me to stay out to do Game of Thrones. I was gone from April till basically Labor Day. So September. Oh. So May, that's June, July, August. It was like 3.5-4 months of being out in a row. I'll do 6 to 8 months a year. On a really, really busy year, I'll do like 8 months out of the 12.
Yeah.
Maybe 9, but generally speaking, you know, you're out for 2 months, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months at a time, whatever. There's
Yeah. And what do you think, if you had to give a tip to someone again that wants to go into touring, what would be the best tip that you can give them?
Well, it comes back to what I started with, which was like volunteering and finding out. You know, you may want to be like, I want to mix bands and be front of house, or I want to be in lighting, or I want to be a tour manager, but you have to research it. Like those jobs, they just don't go away. You have to find out how to do that. So the best way to do that is to volunteer. So if you're in London, go volunteer at a club, be like, hey, try to get on the crew, try to become part of the union and get in and load in and learn about how shows and things work. Volunteer at management companies, volunteer at record labels if they still exist, but just the people with the moving parts, volunteer with them, because you know almost every volunteer that I've met that has had any kind of like drive to do it are in the business now. So you have to zone in on what you want to do, and if you're lighting, that's it. You want to be lighting, well, that's easy. Go to a lighting company and volunteer and learn every single thing that there is to know about lighting. And then, you know, you become like that person that's like, well, that person's been volunteering at every single show. They know how to do this. They know how to do that. Like, let's get them a job. And that's, no one's handing them out right now. So I'm always a proponent of volunteering.
I like that. Yeah. I've had like tips of every single kind, from volunteering to just talk to people, and I think it gets to the same place that you just need to go out there and let people know about you, I guess.
What's your sort of goal personally? Like, what are you trying to get into?
Oh, me. Oh, I would love to become a stage manager. I would love to get into touring, to be honest. Right now, when live music shut down, I was supposed to start this year, try get myself a job into what I wanted to do. But obviously everything shut down. So I said, okay, so how do I meet people now? How do I talk to them? And I said, well, I like Instagram. I'm always on Instagram. And I met Eva, like, I think it was last year. So I asked her, and she was super like excited about the idea and the show. And she came, and then she started like just calling people out and telling them about it.
Eva is amazing. So she's great. There's Brent Hodson just joined us. Another Brent.
Hello.
Hey, Brent, I'm in Matt's sound booth. Just so you know, buddy.
It's big.
So, you know, from a stage managing standpoint, like, I mean, there's many definitions of that. Is it theater? Is it concerts? Is it festivals? Like, there, you can start stage manager and just start writing all these bubbles around what that's going to be. But, you know, stage manager also leads to production assistant, production manager, production coordinator. There's so many like jobs that come out of stage manager because you build a festival and do it. So when that world returns, there's not a shortage of jobs for people that want to do that. You know what I mean? Because not everyone wants to, but most people want that glamorous like touring and get on this and get on the bus. There's stage managers within a tour. There's, you know, so you do a good rapport. And make sure when a tour comes to a building that you're volunteering at or a building that you're working at, and they know that you've done this amazing job. When they're looking to hire somebody in London that they, or to go on tour in Europe, they might be like, hey, she was awesome. Let's call her and see what she's doing. And, you know, there's Q. Yep. Q, Mr. Q just joined us from New Hello. York City. Great guy. Another great candidate. There's so many great candidates coming on here that would be great for your show. Awesome, awesome.
100%, guys. Just heat my DMs and just tell me and I'll put you in the show. Awesome. So now that we're talking about we were talking a bit about your podcast, but I want to get more into it because I really like the idea. It's very similar to what I do, more or less. But anyways, where did the idea come from?
Well, I was touring around I was just trying coffee and all the, this is a weird thing, but I was trying to find the best coffee in the world, right?
Really?
I was doing these little things where I was filming on Instagram stories where I would be like, today's coffee brought to you by, and I would pan out to the Eiffel Tower, or today's coffee brought to you by, and I'd pan out to London Tower or whatever it was. And then it started turning into this fun thing where people were like, well, where's today's coffee from? Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that I was new to coffee. I'd only started drinking coffee a couple years ago. So people were amazed that I was even drinking it. So it was just this funny kind of thing. And it turned into like, people wanting to see it. So then a buddy of mine runs a media network out of Toronto, and it said, hey, listen, you should start documenting your journey around the world, running concerts and trying to find coffee. And I said, well, no one wants to hear me yatter on, so I don't know if it's going to work. They said, just start with like a story. So I started writing a story about coffee assholes and which coffee asshole are you, which is like, you know, what level of coffee asshole are you? Do you wear an apron? Do you wear this? Do you wear that? And it was this funny kind of thing where I actually turned it into a 10-part series. And as I was having more fun with it, and the fact that I wasn't, as mentioned, like I wasn't drinking anymore or anything. So I was kind of like in my room, in my hotel room going, why don't I try to get creative? So then I started turning it into coffee stories and then I was meeting bands and musicians that had a coffee brand. And I was like, okay, I think I can run with this. So I had Ray from like Korn on and Dave from Megadeth, and we were talking about their coffee brand. And then roasters started reaching out to me. And then I got Tim Wendelboe, who I reached out to, who is like one of the best roasters in the world. And I was like, this is actually turning into something. And I was getting a lot of listeners. And then I said to myself, but I can't fill 100 episodes of coffee. Nor will anyone want to listen to it. So one of the guys I was on tour with this summer had said, you know, why don't you add some stuff to your podcast from the standpoint of like other subjects? And I was like, yeah, I was thinking about it. I just didn't know. And then I basically honed in on, well, coffee, music, I'm traveling, and I'm meeting a lot of life people with great life stories. So why don't I just turn it into a 4-part module? Mm-hmm. And so that happened. So I did 10 on coffee, 10 on music. I'm almost done travel, and then I'll switch to life next, which is really great life stories. Very similar to what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
And just talking about, you know, the different things that people are bringing to the world. And it's just been kind of a great creative outlet for me, especially through COVID and all these different things where the world is shut down. It's been great to be able to create new content and different things mm-hmm. for people to listen to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I love this. It's such a cool story. It's kind of similar because before getting Eva into the show, I was interviewing my friends and the people I knew, some people from the UK, some people from Spain. And I was just like talking to them about life, about the topics that we cared about, like and the whole LGBT movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, everything that was going on at the moment, like the pandemic too. And then someone told me, why don't you invite like someone that's inside the music industry, because that's what you want to do at the end. Because my friends were songwriters, producers, artists. And I was like, well, that's actually a really good idea. So yeah, it was at the end of the day, it's people who tell you like, I had this idea. Like, why don't you do this?
You just kind of pull a lot of different ideas. Dusty's in the house. Dustin, hi buddy. a lot of people will suggest different stories and different ways to, you know, hey, you should do this and you should do that. And the great thing about the podcasting side is I had never done it before. I'd started doing it on my phone. Now I have some gear. Got to drop now.
You do. I have to get to your level.
This level cost me $20, so don't worry about it. There's no level. So it's just a matter of like just trying to, you know, with the content the way it's going and just putting out stuff. And I was finding that the pods that I was doing were resonating with people. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of one of those things where, you know, I did one with, as I said, Dave from Megadeth, and people were like, wow, I didn't know he had his own coffee. Or Tim Wendelboe, when we talked coffee about sustainability and, you know, what the farmers are going through, that mm-hmm. people were like, I had no clue. Or mental health, you know, I had Barry from Shinedown, the drummer from Shinedown on, and that band's been through a lot, and just people just telling that story. It just was really cool to kind of be able to tell these little stories, and people seem to resonate with them. So it's a lot of fun. It's a great way to stay creative.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And now that we're coming to the end, we've got like 10 minutes left. Well, people, like everyone who's watching, if you have any questions for Brenton, just leave them here and I'll read them to him. And also just wanted to ask you about what we're going through, like the pandemic, live music shutting down and all of this. Like, where do you think we're headed?
Well, I mean, obviously the whole world, it's not just the concert industry, the whole world has, you know, has just stopped. And I think that it will get back on track. It's just people don't know. You get answers when someone has the flu, you know, generally what that means. Or when someone, you know, has a sore stomach, they, you know, they have this. Or someone has a cold or a cough. People kind of self-diagnose and they can kind of figure it out. The spread of it, no one really knows what it means. Like, no one really knows, like, what it's going to mean in the big picture. So I think what people start being more comfortable with, dare I say vaccine, vaccine isn't necessarily going to solve everything, I don't believe, but I do think that people don't want to be in these giant group settings just yet until they realize that, you know, that their health or their well-being is being taken care of. And there is a bit of like,
yeah,
heavy propaganda on some things. I mean, I've been through it, so I know how it feels to go through it. Obviously,
you told me.
I was one of the first cases of it, and I'm fine, but I'm still having some lingering issues, and that was on a minor case. So if it was a bigger case, I think that you'd have some serious problems because it's not just the flu. So I think what people need to understand is that it really is like, it is kind of a thing. And I think people want the world to get back to normal. And I certainly would love the world to get back to normal, but concerts and things like that are going to be last on the list. And I think that there's a lot of people working towards making that happen. There's a lot of bands that want to get out and do it, but you know, I don't think it can reset when you can only have 7 venues that you can go to.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
and
everything has to, that's what I touched on earlier. Like, it's just not cost effective to go to put a tour together for 10 shows and then leave and put all that infrastructure together. You really have to, you know, you really have to have the ability to go out for 6 weeks and do some mm-hmm. stuff. And I think when you see, you know, shows happening and people coming out of it, and there's not really any reports of people getting sick and all that stuff, I think you're going to start seeing it get back to normal a little bit, and there's going to be new measures in place, and you know, you're getting into the venue is going to be longer, and there's going to be new different like things to like experience, you know, that you didn't have to. But the world changes and we just adapt, and you know, the airports changed after September 11th, concerts are going to change after this, large group gatherings, the way people kind of hang out. So I'm just kind of patiently waiting, and I have all the faith in the world that it will get figured out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of smart people working mm-hmm. towards it. But it comes down to the buying public, and it comes down to what people are comfortable with doing. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the end of the day, they are the audience. So if there's no audience, there's no gig.
Right. So, I mean, what does that mean? And when, you know, who gets permission to put 10,000 people in a building first? We will see. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing sports come back. We're seeing some things come back. So I am encouraged that there will be something down the road. That's not music heals. So it brings people together. It has forever and ever and ever. And I'm a firm believer that it's gonna be the exact same thing. But people just need to know what that's going to look like. And we're all waiting to see what that's going to look like.
Yeah. And one of my last questions is, what do you miss the most about touring?
Well, I love my job. So for me, it's just like, it's just doing the job. I mean, you meet some amazing people, and this is the part for me that's like, I've got some great people all over the world. So when you go to Paris, you can go to the coffee at the same place, or you know, you go to Amsterdam and you meet the same people, or you go to Sweden, whatever it is, it's the people is a big thing. But for me, it's the work that you put in prior to going and running the tour and having it end. Mm-hmm. And for me, I just miss that flow, because there's so many factors that go into putting it together. There's so many factors that happen while it's happening. And then, you know, you move on to the next one, and there's a nice, it's like building a car. You build the car, and then the car leaves, and then the car goes and drives, and then it drives until it. And I just feel like I'm missing that. Okay, that tour is done, and now we're building this tour, and then I'm going to start that one, and we're going to go to the next one. And then, seeing, you know, obviously the music, I'm such a huge fan of music, that watching live shows and live bands every night. And yes,
I love Helen's comment. Yeah. He misses sharing an office with me, and I miss his great playlists. That's cute.
I've got music going in the office at all times, and I miss the music. I miss watching live music. I mean, I spent last summer with Korn and Alice in Chains.
Oh.
I saw Alice in Chains every single night. You know, I saw Jerry Cantrell walking backstage with an acoustic guitar, playing the whole Jar of Flies record while he was just warming up. I'm like, what? Like, it's that kind of stuff, and like that people understand. I missed, you know, just all that kind of stuff. And you know, I was out in the fall, and I was able to sneak away and say, see Helen. Right? Helen was on tour, and she was only an hour away from me. I was able to go up there and say hi and spend the day watching, you know, one of my favorite bands and stuff like that. And I miss that. The music side of it is really tough, because I love live music. I love concerts. I love watching bands do their thing. And I love 12,000 people or 15,000 people in an arena getting exactly what they want when the house lights go out. That's like the greatest feeling in the world, you know.
It's amazing. Yeah. Well, it's been amazing, Brenton. Thank you so much for coming.
I really appreciate it. I think you're doing a great thing here.
Oh, thank you. I'll try my best.
And a lot of guests that are going to be on here that you're going to learn a lot from too. There's a lot of
100.
Hopefully, when this thing gets back to normal, and when I get back to London, we can all do this in person.
And, yeah, let's go for a coffee.
Yeah, that works for me. So,
all right. So, thank you so much, everyone who watched the show as well. And yeah, thank you so much, Brenton. I'll see you then.
All right. Take care. Thanks for having me on.
Bye. See you. Bye.
What happens when we play outside? We become healthier, both mentally and physically. We become more creative and more focused. We connect with nature, each other, and ourselves. Let's Take This Outside, a new podcast hosted by me, Marianne Iveson, an aspiring outdoor athlete and nature lover. I speak to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about their connection to nature, how it affects their performance and everyday life. Let's Take This Outside, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and at letstakethisoutside.ca.
I'm Connie Thiessen, the host of Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast. We focus on Canada and the challenges facing Canadian radio and TV, as well as highlighting those moving the industry forward from podcasting and streaming to new broadcast tech. Check us out at broadcastdialogue.com or your favorite podcast app.